ready.
Welcome to Unlimited Realities. I am your host, Lisa Zimmer, and I want to welcome all of you for listening today. I have a very special guest. I'm really, really excited to share his wisdom with you guys today. His name is, although he prefers to be called Jim, we are blessed to have our guest today, James A. O'Conn, who has written The Lost Secrets of Maya Technology, James O'Conn. And we are going to introduce him as Jim. So, Jim, thank you so much for being on our show today. And thank you for writing this book. This is a fabulous book with chock full of wisdom and insight. And I'm really looking forward to sharing this with the audience today. How are you doing, Jim?
I'm doing well, and thank you for having me with you.
Well, it is my pleasure. This has been such a great book. And, you know, we talk a lot about ancient intelligence, ancient civilizations, and many times we start with the Egyptian culture. But what I was really awakened by throughout your book was that many things in the Mayan civilization preceded the Egyptian awareness and knowledge. So I'm just going to start off from the basics, and we're going to build up here. But tell us a little bit about what inspired you to write this book, because I did not introduce you properly. You are a professional engineer with decades of experience designing award-winning projects, and you spent 40 years investigating Maya engineering feats and lost Mayan technology. So let's talk a little bit about what inspired you to write this book and how it came to be.
I have to go back to my childhood. Here in Georgia, I lived in a small town outside of Atlanta, which is not part of Atlanta, and I played in the trenches that were dug in the Civil War inside of a battlefield called Kennesaw Mountain. And then we just, you know, we knew what they were, but they were trenches, but we found rusted armament and spent shell, and we knew what the implication of the earthworks were, and that went on. It gave me a sense of history, and I knew that, you know, we lived in a city, the only American city ever totally destroyed by war, then that was another chink in the armor of history. I lacked a background in whatever happened before 1865. Went to high school and had a great history teacher who, rather than teaching about Napoleon and Charlemagne exclusively, he taught about lost civilizations, occult religions, and extinct languages. That really whetted my appetite, joined with my historic thirst. And I began reading the books of the great authors who had experienced or wrote about the conquest of America by the Spanish, Prescott and John Lloyd Stevens. So I went to Georgia Tech, which a technical university, which doesn't teach much history, so I had to rely on my own resources for that. But I did learn world-class engineering, so I can marry the two. I happened to marry the two fields together, the history / archaeology and the technical wisdom that I was, well, it's not wisdom, it's a hard science. Technical skills I was taught at Georgia Tech. And I began work as an engineer. And after a few years, I took half a year off and bought a Volkswagen camper and took my family and myself. We traveled south of the border, down Mexico way, all the way down into what was called British Honduras, and it's now Belize. And stayed with in the local areas of the ruins, visiting the sites that were available then, which were very few that you could get to, that were tourists or had roads going to them. And I began to feel a kinship with designers, the engineers, the architects, and the technicians of the Maya world that had built these beautiful cities of really terrific design with the carvings that were otherworldly and a special kind of structure that lasted in the jungle for 1,200 years. So I would ask questions. This now we're getting to the book part.
Okay,
because archaeologist.
So that was your passion. That was, you know, it's interesting to me how oftentimes we're led down one path and we become very skilled at one path and then meander into our passions, and somehow the roads twist and turn together, and how spirit and God just kind of blend those two right in sync for us. Because the exciting part, and we're going to get into this a little bit deeper, but you actually ended up discovering a bridge in the Mayan civilization that had been overlooked many times by some archaeological digs. Is that correct?
That's correct. The site had been explored since 1880, and you know, the Maya civilization only been rediscovered in 1842 and disclosed in some books by John Lloyd Stevens, and became very popular, but very few people visited the area because of unrest. There was caste wars, etc. So a chap went to the site that we're talking about. It's called Yashilan, named Maudsley, Albert Maudsley, and he took photographs and made drawings of the site, and I was able to use those to do some of my research. But the site had been there waiting to be the part I was very interested in, which was the bridge, waiting to be discovered for, at the time, 110 years by the time I got there. So
wow.
That's one of my big skills, is finding hidden secrets that are in plain sight.
Well, and that was quite a good secret you unearthed there, Jim.
Well, it took me several years to get archaeology on board. Scientists and engineers jumped right on it. It was very logical. The city needed a bridge to get across that river to exist, because it was in this huge oxbow of the river. And during the rainy season, 6 months of really heavy rain and 6 months of what's called seasonal desert, you could die of thirst in the dry season if you don't have adequate water. And this river was 600 feet wide during the winter when the rainstorms came. And nobody ever, even though there was two, we didn't, nobody put two and two together, or two and six together, whatever it came up to statistically indicate the bridge. I put it all together because I had to help with computers and 3D fly-throughs and stuff like that, and satellites and aerial photography, and pulled it off.
That's amazing. Now, in your book, we find out that the rediscovery of the Mayan civilization in the mid-19th century actually shocked the academic world, and it absolutely resulted in the rewriting of history. How did this happen, and why? Well, I mean, what gave them how did they like grab the concept and say, okay, whoa, did we screw up? I mean, how did that happen?
Well, we got to go back to the conquistadors.
Yes.
They took over the, you know, basically Mexico and the northern part of South America, and they forbade anybody. It was like during the colonial period, which lasted from 1520 until 1820, which is like 300 years, they almost forbade travel into the country. And in fact, Protestants were banned from entering the country. They wouldn't allow any exploration. They didn't do any exploration themselves. They were not interested in the old cities that rumors came up from the jungle that existed in the deep rainforest, because there was nothing there for them to gain. There was no gold, no treasure, et cetera, and there was no market in pre-Columbian art at that time, because nobody knew that this civilization existed. And in 1820 came, that was the independence of Mexico and Central America, and it was almost as bad then, because there was a lot of roaming gangs and there was political problems, etc. So one of the elements that got John Lloyd Stevens, the first person that wrote a book about and brought out drawings of the cities, the ancient cities, he got a job as a as a diplomat, as a roving ambassador, as it were, to the Central American Republic, as this whole area is called, and they gained him access. And he had lots of interesting close calls with all kinds of bad guys, let's call them. But he persisted and wrote books about and traveled widely and came up with unbelievable. Actually, his partner, Frederick Catherwood, came up with unbelievable drawings of these exotic cities with the otherworldly art and unbelievable symbols that he conjectured were probably hieroglyphics, because he had already written books about Egypt, and he recognized the form of a language. The fact that there was a civilization that had high-rise buildings, that they had obviously a language, blew the minds of the world of archaeology, blew the world of history scholars, etc., that there was a civilization existing in the jungles of what actually was North America that actually created their, what turned out to be the science and their technology and all their wisdom in isolation. Actually, there was no outside influences, only the local, you know, lore, et cetera, that contributed to their sciences and their technology. And that was an amazing thing.
Yeah. And there's, you know, there had to have been a lot of fear with the Spanish conquistadors to have taken all of these wise transcripts and books and record keeping and all of these things that the Mayans had accumulated in their development and their civilization. And they actually ended up destroying all of their written knowledge except for one book that was found, the Dryden Codex. Can we talk about why that book is so important and what was in it that we've been able to use as a guide today in our lives?
I will do that, but there are actually four books, and I'll explain where they came from. If we go back a little bit, when the conquistadors took over, the Maya civilization collapsed for 600 years. But the knowledge of in the books and the books themselves had been carried on by intelligentsia and priests or whoever was involved in being able to read and write the Maya script. And they kept, as you can imagine, these are paper books, so they had to keep redoing the books and copying the books. So the books that we found were copies of books that were originally carried out during the classic period, which was 600 years before. So these were copies, just like the monks in the monasteries in the Dark Ages. And we owe our, you know, knowledge of the past to their copying of the manuscripts. You know, this is like the same kind of thought process. So when they came, they being the conquistadors, they took, of course, we know about the Aztecs. They fell within a year. The Mayas didn't fall easily. The first attack was, invasion was driven off in 1532, but they came back and finally took over the northern Yucatan in 1562. Now, or a little earlier. But anyway, they at the time they came in, took all the books, considered them to be instruments of the devil, heathen, and they also had the Inquisition. The priests were probably worse than the soldiers, and they were pretty bad. And they burned all the books and just absolutely, I guess they killed different ways. The intelligentsia could read these things. They forbade the teaching or reading of the books, but somehow four of them escaped. Now, the Maya didn't go easy. We'll come back to the books again. It took 150 years for the Spanish to take the last Maya stronghold, citadel in what is now Guatemala. It's a town called Tayasal. And it fell in 1697. 1697, we were already a British colony. Harvard, a great university, was 63 years old. I mean, they already had the Salem-Witch trials. Peter Minuet was running Amsterdam. It was like parallel with our history. So we're really connected in that way. But to the Maya, in a lot of ways, we could have, instead of having to break the code 300 years later, if Sony had any, you know, if we had any power and the British said we in the colony, we could have gone over and picked up the pieces or something like that. But anyway, after all this happened, four books survived, and they didn't. They weren't even discovered until the late 18th and early 19th century. Of course, the Dresden Codex, which you mentioned, was found in Dresden, and the Paris Codex was found in a library in the French Bibliothèque. And there's two books, well, there's the Madrid Codex, which they think was actually a trophy, a war trophy brought home by Cortez, the head of the conquistadors, to his family in Spain. And then there was the one found in the 1880s in a cave in Chiapas. That's called the Grolier. It's probably the one that's in worse shape. So there's four, but the one of them is the most important. The one book that is most important, the Codices, is the Grolier with all its unbelievable mathematics and calendars and periodic charts of different planets and the sun, eclipses of the moon. And you're correct. That was the big book.
And so all of these are considered the codices. Is that right?
All
four of these books? Okay. And then within each book are their diagrams and their ways of teaching as far as astronomy and things that they were able to construct and all of that. Is that right? Like each book is a different set of instructions or information. Is that correct?
That's correct. But mostly they deal with astronomy. This book's got away. Although the priests who were befriending the Maya intellectuals back in the during the conquest read books and saw books that dealt with natural history and medicine and history itself. One priest describes a book that had 800 years of history into it. And so it had a whole range of books like you would find in a modern library. And there
right.
were... Some say hundreds, some say thousands were burned at Mani in the famous Auto de Fe in 1562, I think. So
and there's there's such a tragedy in the burning of such incredible material that would have definitely changed our lives. I'm certain. But we go back into the Mayan brain and the Mayan theories and what really triggered them. And it seems that the Mayans were quite obsessed with time and the timing of things. And it also came through that they looked at time both as a linear concept and a cyclic concept. Can we talk a little bit about why the Mayans may have been so obsessed with time? And then I would like to get into the wobble period and their calendar after that.
Okay. Let's go back. We're talking about 3,000 year, well, 2,900 year. We'll round it off to 3,000. 3,000 year civilization. It's the longest in history. Of course, there was no way to invade them because they were not an empire. They were 50 independent city-states that supported each other, and sometimes with war, but somebody else would come in and help out, and things would go back to civility again. But that was one of the elements, in my opinion, that made them last so long was the fact they had a stable political history. And they had a very large trade business going with all the civilizations north and south of the area. So they... When they started becoming a civilization, let's start back in the early pre-classic. Can you imagine how clear the sky was in those days? I mean, a transparent, crystal clear sky at night. And this was the day before electric lights and all the smog and everything, so they could look into the heavens. And I know you've experienced this feeling of being in a very clear area where you can look at the stars and just feel like you could almost touch them. They feel so close.
Right.
So they had this unbelievable feeling of being close to the cosmos. And after centuries and maybe a millennium of studying the stars and becoming familiar with them, they begin to name them. And time, the wanderers, the planets, Mercury and Venus and Mars, etc. And they called, they had names, and they had one that account. So you can see where the need for mathematics and astronomy and a written way of record keeping would rise up out of this intellectual crowd that was looking at the stars. But also, by timing all these things, we get to the time. Mm-hmm. They got into space and time and developed what is known as the quadripartite cosmic philosophy. They had divided the cosmos into four elements, four quadrants, and the four parts were represented in time as the three dimensions of, like in trigonometry or geometry or calculus, X, Y, and Z. And they added time as a factor T. So they had a four-dimensional look at time, and they were obsessed with it. And as you said, they had linear time, they had cyclic time. They looked mm-hmm. at time as undifferentiated, past, mm-hmm. present, and future. And they were very interested in the quality as well as the quantity of time. The quality is past and present. Now, when they calculated time, they looked at these four dimensions, which is very similar to the modern concept of the space-time continuum, where you actually have the ability to place an event not only in time but in space. And that was an amazing, to me, that was an amazing concept. But this, you see how we're getting into a cognitive thought process here?
Right,
about
right.
Time and about space and about the Earth and the stars and what they meant. They meant to the Maya. They became a belief concept, not a religion so much, but they used these time elements to go back to find a similar event and then cycle forward and place the time in the future when they would plan important events like coronations, wars, etc. Sometimes they were called Star Wars because they predicted the dates by using the stars. But the amount of time, and that's obsession with time, made them special and grew their the sciences, the mathematics, the astronomy, and the one of the five original written languages in the world. That's a big factor. That plus the fact they were the best astronomers in the world. I mean, every calculations of the periodicities, the rotation of the sun, Venus, and Mars, and cycles of the moon were within seconds of our modern calculations. So they were really smart and really good, and they worked at it a long time. And I keep using time as an element because look what today they had a ceremony for Neil Armstrong, the first man to walk on the moon.
Right.
That was almost 50 years ago. I mean, that was before we were 2 centuries old, and we're talking about a 30-century civilization. Just think what we could do with, you know, correcting mistakes, going back and starting again, trial and error, any way you want to think of it. But they got it right in the end. And they, because they got it right, they started building up these classes. They had the scientists, the elite. They had the ruling class, elite. They had religious class, elite. They needed better buildings. They needed cities. They needed functional spaces to work in. And there comes the with the need for cities and the growth of the population. Here comes the need for technology and tool making, making cement, and collecting and saving water during the rainy season so it could be used for the cities and for the farms during the dry season. And on with their roads and their bridges, et cetera, which are, you've mentioned a few of these. So that brings up date on the time because they were really driven by time. And we see that in the interest that people have taken in their record keeping and dates. They were unbelievable with dates, chronicling an event, past, future, et cetera. And we're lucky they were carved on monuments like Stella. These are these large let's call them billboards that they have out in the plazas, and they survived where the books did not, except for a few. And they give us a real good look at the Maya and their thought of time, and that's where this date 13.0.0.0 came from as the end of the current world period, as they call it, or creation. It depends on who you're talking to, what they call the five periods that they derive from the wobble of the Earth. And then does that take us to the calculation of the precession of the Earth now?
Well, now, they have this each section at 25,800 years, which, like you were just saying, the next period ends in our calculation December 21st, 2012. And there's been so much hype for so many years that, be prepared for the doomsday, be prepared for, all of these fear-induced concepts that have run rampant all over in regard to 12/21/2012. Now, the Mayans didn't look at the changing of the calendar as an end of a period. Is that correct? They looked at it as a dawning, didn't they?
Well, it was like our Y2K. When we came close to the end of the first millennium, second millennium, rather, and 1999 came up, everybody was predicting terrible things, and we had the computer to work about. We were all said the computers are all going to not function because of the inability to change over the numbers, et cetera, and planes are going to fall from the sky. I remember all the things.
Right.
But
we were all fearful.
I kept track of the geologic data and the records because being a structural engineer, I'm an expert in earthquakes. And NASA. And I still get four or five updates every day on NASA. So let's take us to the Maya first, okay?
Okay.
Actually, I hate to correct you, but it was 25,800 for the whole circle of precession. They broke into five pieces, which were 5,126 years and 8 days. Not to be picky, but that's a big difference between the two. So the whole cycle was 25,600, and each of the five creations was 5,126 years or so. So can you imagine when they finally broke the code, somewhere back around 500 B.C., let's say, or 300 B.C., don't know when they amazingly came up with this number for the total cycle of precession. So let's say you and I, we're two Maya astronomers, and we say we broke the code. We got it now. This thing, we checked it out. It is 25,800. We've divided into five parts, and there's five parts that are 5,123 years and 128 days. Good. And when I look at it, I said, so when did this start? When does it end? This is not a joke. This is probably the way. Because I've been involved in the science that figure out that, oh, hey, we found it. Where did it come from type of thing, okay? So they had established a beginning and an end. And they knew that it had to be before they could track time back. So they probably maybe said, let's say we're in the middle now, okay?
Okay.
So they went, they went forward because they knew they'd already picked an end date. And they picked a time, and they really knew how to unbelievably predict the periodicities and the movement of the stars and the Milky Way and the Venus planets. So they picked a time that would be really good. Hey, let's pick the first of the year. Let's pick New Year's. You may not know this, but December 21st is not only the winter solstice, but it is also the New Year in the Maya calendar.
So they
picked
New
Year in 2012. And in 2012, the black rift that they call the womb of the Milky Way would be somewhere over the primary zenith of the sun on the first day of winter, in the winter solstice.
Okay.
This is the way the scientists explained to me. So we got to go back and reconstruct this. They could do that. They knew that the cycle of the Earth and cycle of the... So they picked a day in 2012, and they picked a day that was where the the womb is, or the black rift would be directly over the sun at noon or whatever they call it, midday. And that's how they picked the day, in my opinion, okay, because that's the scientific opinion. That's pretty logical. And
okay.
So they've got a date. But then again, they said, would say, less with that, at that point, they would start the next cycle, the next 5,123 years and 28 days. So there will be another cycle. In fact, there's been another calendar found. There's only been two calendars ever found. One was in the Dresden Codex. That's the one everybody's been using. And the other one was in just recently at a place called Chultun in Guatemala, where they found one that went to 17 baktuns, which is 17.0.0.0 instead of 13, which would give us another 1,124 years. So it would take us to 31, 36, when we would postpone the same thing we're doing now, you know, end of the world scenarios. So, am I giving you too much information?
No, go ahead. It's you know, what I'm trying to get to is dispelling that fear
exactly.
aspect that every
I'm getting
right.
to that.
Gotcha.
Before,
I'm with
recently,
you.
And I mean recently, like 2 months ago, there was only one place in all the Maya, like 40,000 monuments, where the date was written. It was at a place called Tortuguero in Mexico, and
okay.
it was on a stele, and it said, in this date, 13.0.0, he was a minor god, and I can't remember his name right now, he shall come down and get dressed. Well, that was a nice message, because he's coming down to get dressed for what? A party, because that's New Year's, et cetera. So people have been debating over what he's getting dressed for. Yeah, the modern Maya don't use that calendar anymore. They, you know, since they were converted to European methodologies, they've used the same Gregorian calendar that we all use. So there's been no portentous time about December 21st, or portentous forecast about December 21st in the Maya world. And I've been watching NASA alerts on asteroids, satellites, and there doesn't seem to be any bothering us. Or there's some that might hit in another 4,000 years, but we're looking for something that will come in the next 3 months or so. And my research into earthquakes and the polar shift, I'm not kidding, I've really spent time on this. It doesn't show any increasing incident of large earthquakes.
Mm-hmm.
And the polar shift, it did move 3 inches in 2004 when they had that huge earthquake in Indonesia that caused a tsunami, killed all those people, 250,000 folks. And,
right,
and
right.
But they can calculate. The Earth has been, and the axis have been very stable based on its position with the rest of the Earth, not the wobble, or that still goes on in a 25,800-year cycle. So I have not seen any indications, and archaeologists who study this have not seen any indication. NASA doesn't see any indication of a doom or a disaster on that day, and it's made me opine that the worst thing you have to fear on the morning of December 21st is you've only got 4 more shopping days till Christmas.
And that is a
funny,
truism.
It's true. It's true.
It is a truism.
Only guy that had ever argued with me was a really wise guy, archaeologist, said, I don't agree. I said, why? He said, I'm a bachelor. I only need one.
Yeah.
That was as good a comeback as I've gotten.
And he just needs to go to Walgreens and get it done all
the time. Yeah, right.
All right. I have a question for you. Now, the Mayans are, like you had said, is one of the 5 original written languages and script languages, and I find that is a fascinating aspect. It's one of the most compelling aspects that really gives the Mayans the credibility that they deserve in regard to being a pioneer in regard to civilized culture. Now, big question here, Jim. How did they know what they know? Where did they get this information?
That's the title of Episiography. It was the study of how do we know what we know, and I took that, and chapter 3 was how did they know what they knew, and exactly what you just asked. That men in a civilized, organized, intelligent group, I'm talking about men and women, I'm talking man as a civilized.
I gotcha.
Seem to have periods in their civilization when they need something. It's called comparative analysis in anthropology. And there's time when you, like studying the stars and counting them, and what's the name of the star again up there? And God, let's write it down. You need writing, you need mathematics, and you need astronomy, and you need how to know how to make tools, and you need how to build buildings, and you need, and these things are natural. The Maya didn't invent cities, but they really loved them because they had 50 of them in their 125,000, 50 city-states. I mean, there was more than 50 cities because the big cities were there, and they had smaller cities in each of these in an area that's about the size of New Mexico. So that's a lot of cities, but they didn't have – they set the cities up so they only had like 3 days walking distance between them, and it was a very convenient methodology. And so they had the cities, and so they needed what city folk need. This sounds like Curly and Risky Business. But anyway, they needed water because they knew they had first of all, they needed buildings. They needed streets. They needed drainage. They needed garbage removal. They needed water badly because there was, in the 6 months of dry season, there was no lakes or rivers, very few in the Yucatan, because and I missed this completely. The platform of the Yucatan is a very thin layer of soil that rides on top of a 3,000 or 4,000 thick layer of limestone. And the top layers is what's called karstic limestone, and it's a porous limestone. So rain, it's described 6 months a year, rains very hard. It didn't run down into gullies and into rivers and streams and into rivers and into lakes. It went right into the ground, maybe a little runoff, hit the rock, and the rock sucked it right in because like a sponge. And it went right down to the famous, it's called the Yucatan Aquifer, the groundwater, which moved it swiftly out to sea and into the Caribbean Sea. And one of the things that's amazing, they had to save water, but out at sea, maybe 100, 200 yards out, there's actually springs bubbling up, fresh water in the middle of this salt water. So the people on the coast had two ways to get water. They had the water coming from the bubbling up of springs and these natural wells called cenotes. But I'm getting ahead of myself. So we're talking about where did they come up with all their science? We talked about that. And the technology. The technology was a need to feed people and get them water. And water was the number one need for people and for agriculture to make it grow and enable it to, well, with the advances in agricultural methods they had, they were able to grow four times the amount of food in the same land that they could have done with conventional methods. So they were way ahead and built this, we'll get ahead of myself again, big 15 million population that's on land that should have only been able to support 2 million. So they had to keep the water and the agricultural levels high in order to feed the people, plus have plenty of food for export. And they were big exporters, and trade was a big business with the Maya. So getting back to how did they come up with the stuff, it was a matter of need. They needed something. And like I said, they had time. They had time to start doing these cities, building these cities 300 B.C., I mean, big cities. And they worked at it for 1,200 years, and that's a long time. I guess they changed some design, but all the basic stuff, the way they got water, the way they stored water, the way they built their buildings, the structure was the same. However, the outside looked different because there are regional styles in the local archaeological and artistic styles that differed widely. But there was always very fine carvings and stonework that was involved with the facades of these buildings. So, the answer is when they had a need, they worked on it, and they finally got it right.
Okay, so I'm going to interject a little bit, because my next question is going to have your architectural analytical brain spinning. There's many theories out there that a lot of our ancient civilizations were in contact with a higher intelligence or possibly alien intelligence. Is there any indication on any of the information you have found or you're aware of in your 40 years of excavating that that is a possibility?
We're not really, because as a civil engineer, you know, we're the field of engineering that takes care of water and bridges and roads and buildings, and even we design the structures for rocket ships. So we take it from the basic all the way up to the top. So I've looked at things that I've examined closely from a technical point of view, and everything that they've done was, I think, homegrown and born in the Yucatan. But we're talking about the hard science. We're talking about the buildings and their structures and the water storage systems and the roads and the tools and even their giant canoes that plied the seas. But the thinkers, the intellectuals that were really deep into the belief system of the Quad Apartheid cosmic philosophy. Now, I'm only dabbled in this, so I'm not deep into it. Believe they could do teleportation, out of body experiences, distant viewing. I think I'm using the right terms for
you. Right, you are.
And yes. Actually, John Lloyd Stevens, when he wrote his book, claims he witnessed one of these distant viewings through a crystal ball. Yes, but nobody's ever found a crystal ball. Crystal skulls, yes, but we don't know about those guys. But there was a belief in the priest and the higher up that they could actually travel. And they did have something else working for them, okay? And this helped in astronomy. They had 100 different hallucinogens that were natural that they developed. And they would, what do you want? What do you need? You know, it's like the old days in Greenwich Village when I was going to graduate school, you know, in the 60s. So, but the Europeans only had 50 drugs at that time when they landed. But we're talking about way before the Europeans ever got there. So they had, let's say, added value. That plus the fact that they would do bloodletting sacrifices. Self, I don't know, I'm talking about killing somebody else. I'm talking about actually piercing a tender part of your body that would bleed well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and actually getting faint and having these drugs. And this is a state when they saw their ancestors and saw the vision serpent and could tell the future or see the past. This comes from the books and stuff like that. So I never had a chance to use any of this stuff, and I will not pierce my penis for anybody. You know, I don't believe in bloodletting that way. I would probably maybe do a thumb or something like that. But that was a big deal, particularly for the royals in bloodletting ceremonies, and they could see. You see this in the sculptures, the carvings, the bas-reliefs, where you'll see a person looking up at a serpent with a face coming out, which is a relative speaking to them. But they believed. That's all I can say. You know,
and so in their faith and in their belief, you believe that they maybe have tapped into some collective consciousness or some awareness that may have helped them develop some of these things? Is that what you're saying? Or do you think it
not,
was
I, well,
more
let me
of a
say,
collective
the only way would help
group?
Them, it was really... really good stuff, and they gathered a really bunch, a big group of scientists. They might have needed more buildings or better buildings or something like that. So that would have promoted the lifestyle more than the basics. I'm only talking about the basics in the book: water, roads, buildings, etc. But I think the way they lived was probably absolutely determined by some of these visions.
And
that's my opinion.
Okay. And so let's get into some of the incredible inventions that the Mayans developed, which, you know, in many times the Mayans were like 1,000 years ahead of the Greeks, the Romans, even the Egyptians in many of their discoveries, scientific and even just in tools. Let's talk about some of the Mayan achievements in technology. Their number chart was different than any other number chart that had been derived in the Greek or the Roman existence, because they added the significance of the number zero. How did that change our number chart for us?
Well, by the time we discovered the Maya, we were using the number in mathematics in a proper way, just like the Maya, not just as a placeholder. And placeholder is like when you use a zero and 10 as one, or 100 with two, or three, it designates the range of numbers that go behind that. That's called a placeholder. I had to look at it myself, okay? So they had it as a placeholder like the Babylonians and the Hindus, who got it around 600 A.D., who gave it to the Arabs, who gave it to the Europeans, who used it as a placeholder first. But their mathematics evolved farther, and they used it as a real number that is the limit between positive numbers and negative numbers as we use it today in mathematics, where we or in engineering, any not even in you don't use it so much in accounting, but you know you use it a lot in normal mathematics. They were so far ahead in that respect that they just blew everybody away, that they knew this when it was finally deciphered in the late 19th century that they had the number zero. And the magic thing was that everybody seen Roman numerals and Egyptian symbolism, the numbers, the Maya, and ours. We have 10 symbols. You know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 0. They only had three. They had a dot, a bar, and a shell-like zero. It was an open shell, like an oval. And they took these and constructed the most basic, elegant mathematics system. And they did their counting and their mathematics and their division and their addition in a vertical manner, like I show in the book. First line would be 20. Second line would be 400. Third line would be 8,000. It would be the power of 20, 1,600. Then you go to another level of 3 million to 100. You know, it's just simplistic as hell. And they came up with it on their own. They didn't have any models like
right.
Romans
I
and
mean,
Egyptians,
that was
et cetera.
Absolutely phenomenal. And the simplistic chart that you have there, it's a no-brainer. And it just, you know, the wisdom in the simplicity for me is just astounding, that this preceded what was recorded knowledge. It was this, you know, the Mayans really weren't given a whole lot of credibility. I mean, compared to the Greeks and the Romans and the Europeans, it was a much different, almost like the Spanish conquistadors really kind of made them out to be savages, and that kind of stayed, you know, it was kind of like it undermined their intelligence.
You know, I've often thought about what would have happened if the Maya civilization hadn't collapsed in 910, but had continued on until the 16th century, and this civilization met the Spanish.
Right.
They may have had gamma rays or some kind of ray weapons or some. They were stronger than the Spanish. They knew how to pierce the armors and battle through the you know, the guns and the horses, et cetera, and they were not still the civilization. They were, you know, they were, they had the culture, and they were Maya, but they were pretty tough guys. So
right.
I often wonder if they continued another 600 years of progress in their sciences and their technology, what we would have seen, you know, and the Spanish have been really impressed. because remember accounts of Cortez when he saw the capital city of the Aztecs, Tenochtitlan. He couldn't believe
right.
his most beautiful city, the taller buildings. It was more beautiful than the square at Salamanca, he said. And
right.
that wasn't much of a square. But anything, that's all they had. That was,
right.
that was the maximum they had in Europe. And they were amazed. Then a couple years later, he tore it down stone by stone as he took over the city. But they didn't even know what the Maya had, which was much more, many more cities. Aztec had one city, big city. The Maya had more than 50.
Well, you know, the Mayans were quite an advanced awareness and civilization. I'm just going to go through the list of some of the Mayan achievements that they were able to achieve both in technology and in their civilization. They were one of the five written original languages. They created the significance of the number zero in the number chart. They created tool fabrication out of jadeite, which is harder than iron, and obsidian, which is the glass made of lava. They used hydraulic cement and cast-in-place concrete. They also developed sophistication of Mayan sculpture. They did long span and high rise structures. They did water management systems. That blows my mind. I remember when I went to Chichen Itza and they were educating us on their underground water system. Blew my mind. They did the Mayan superhighway system, the Mayan bridge engineering and transportation system. I mean, it was incredible, their engineering genius at that time when, you know, you're developing civilization in a rainforest that is far away from any known society or civilization, and having these incredible awarenesses and tools that they're using. I mean, it was really a phenomenal feat. It's something that I don't understand why there's not more written about it.
Well, archaeologists have PhDs. Well, one of my friends is a famous archaeologist, calls it the union card, a PhD from Harvard. But it's in anthropology or it's in art history. There's no technology in there, no mathematics, no chemistry of cement, no physics, no thermodynamics, you know, the kind of stuff I sweated through in college, through all my colleges. Okay, so I had another background. When I viewed a city or I viewed a mystery they couldn't figure out, and instead of being called a temple to the turtle god, I saw a bridge pier. Instead of having something called a ceremonial weapon, I saw a chisel or an awl. That's how my background in engineering enabled me to see these things that they couldn't see. They could not even see. And I say, wait, how did they make carve that beautiful stone? He said, well, it's soft when it's first mined. He said, that's igneous rock. That means it's made with, it's like granite, okay? They couldn't use, you know, soft limestone-like material. They go, well, I don't know. Maybe they did it some way. Well, they didn't question it. They had plenty of other things to work on. They had the breaking the code. They had the religions. They had the ancestry. They had all these nature versus nurture type of questions. It was too hard. They needed somebody in, I can't tell you how many times. A famous archaeologist told me one time when he met me, he said, what do we need you for? We don't need engineers. We know how to do this. That's the reason right there. They overlooked it. Because, one, they weren't interested in it, and secondly, they didn't have the education. They had the talent. These are brilliant men. But they could play the bass violin beautifully, but they could not throw a fastball. So that's the difference between me and the rest of these guys. And I wrote a book on it. Oh, another thing. I have a famous quote. Archaeology is not a profession. It is a vendetta. There's more jealousy and more fear of being attacked if you come up with a concept that is contrary to popular opinion or myth, and they'll do it. They'll tear you to holy pieces. You think that bothers me? You think, Lisa, that I'm afraid of being criticized by the, by the archaeological societies and the archaeological press? No, I'm just an old engineer that goes down in the jungle and drinks cold Coronas, throws back a few tequilas, and I said, you know what? This is like saying, you know, you talked about all those. It was little things that amazed me, too. Like the inside of these Maya structures, they're called vaults. They have a curved ceiling. Nobody's even noticed it. They called it the false arch. That curved ceiling is a parabola. It was used to reflect light. So the Maya had a little light source, like just a little lamp. It would reflect light back 7 or 8 times. They don't even know this. I've never even, you're hearing it now for the first time. They developed the method of vulcanization 3,000 years before Charles Goodyear was born, 2600 actually. When they knew how to mix rubber with sulfur, they used the juice from the morning glory vine, and they could make unbelievable bouncing balls that would last for a long time, and they'd use it in a ball game, and on and on and on like that. They had just little things in their life that made their life easier, but they were just tweaks of science that we didn't have for thousands of years.
And that's, you know, that's the beauty of the fact that you were able to convince them that there was a bridge under all this overgrowth that you actually found in the Mayan civilization, and it was unearthed. And I find that, you know, you actually changed the course of history as far as that aspect went, because had you not been adamant in regard to them searching and digging and looking, the bridge never would have been discovered, and that there's going to be more that's found within that bridge, I'm sure, over the next...
Sure.
I
want to make one little point. They didn't help. I cut my way through the undergrowth so I could take compass readings on the two piers in the river and backside on the structures of the bridge in the plaza. I took the videos. I took the pictures. I made the drawings. You know, I'm self-funded, so I didn't have a whole crew going down with me. I had one archaeologist to witness this. And I didn't know it was the longest bridge in the ancient world. Neil Fitzsimons, the late Neil Fitzsimons, is an engineering historian. I told Neil about it. He kept a chart of bridges from, you know, 500 B.C. all the way to the Verrazano Narrows and bigger bridges. And he called me up one day and said, you know what? They didn't build a longer bridge than the Bridge of Ashkelon until 1377. I said, what? He said, you have the oldest bridge. You found the oldest bridge in ancient times.
Wow.
It's amazing.
That is amazing.
I didn't know that. I just thought it was a neat trick by Maya.
Look at you, Jim. Look what you did.
Yep, I'm pretty proud.
You changed history. I mean, that's a phenomenal thing, and I'm talking to you. I think that's absolutely incredible. And the information that we have yet to unearth, it's very promising. It's very hopeful
in our
society that we could gain some insight, some additional wisdom from them.
Just let me give you one little thing.
Yes.
There's only 40 sites been investigated out of the 4,000 that have been discovered.
Wow.
Yeah, go ahead now. Sorry,
That's incredible. That's incredible. I want to bring our listening audience to your website to read more about you, and it's at www.theoldexplorer.com, and it's there that you can find more about Jim's journey. And I want to thank you, Jim, for being my guest today. This has been a wealth of information and insight, and I've really enjoyed reading your book and reading about the Mayan technology that has been lost and not really discussed and so pertinent, so important to our society. So thank you for doing your purpose and soul calling in finding your passion, following your passion, writing this incredible book and bringing this wisdom to us. I want to thank you, James O'Conn, The Lost Secrets of Maya Technology, and you can find James at the following website, www.theoldexplorer.com. And Jim, thank you so much for being my guest today. You have about 30 seconds. Anything you'd like to say to the audience?
Just a commercial appeal. Buy books. You can find them at Amazon.com, and it's ranked in the top 100 of Maya books, and this morning it's pretty high, and I think this afternoon will go higher, because every time I have a nice interview like this, people buy books.
Oh, yeah,
thank
they
you.
Will. And I'm already getting emails in my email file. So I will be directing them to Amazon.com. The Lost Secrets of Maya Technology, James O'Conn. I suggest all of you read it. It's a wealth of information. God bless you, James. Thank you for your work and your inspiration.
Thank you.
Thank you for being my guest today. Have a wonderful week. And thank your wonderful wife, Carol, for arranging this. God bless
thank
her
you.
As well. Have a wonderful week. Bye, everyone.
Bless
take
you.
Care.
And God bless America.
God bless America. Thank you, James. Bye-bye.